A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's basically asking what money actually is when you never touch it. He says he barely uses cash, would happily never use it again, and if his entire experience of money is just a balance on a screen and a tap of his phone, then what are we actually doing when we earn and spend? If there's no gold backing it, is its value purely from being exchangeable for cash on demand? And what's the fundamental commitment that gives the whole system legitimacy as a medium of exchange?
This is one of those questions where the moment you start digging, you realize almost everything people assume about money is wrong. Not in a conspiratorial way, in a "the plumbing is completely different from what the faucet suggests" way.
The faucet being the banking app on your phone.
And here's the thing. Daniel's framing already contains the tension. He says, if it's not backed by gold, is its value purely from being exchangeable for cash? But that just pushes the question back one step. What gives cash its value? It's also not backed by gold. We haven't been on a gold standard since Nixon closed the window in 1971.
The question eats its own tail. If digital money gets legitimacy from being convertible to cash, and cash gets legitimacy from, what, being printed on nice paper? Then we haven't actually answered anything.
And that's why we need to start with what's actually happening when you tap your phone. Not the philosophy first, the mechanism. Because the mechanism turns out to be the philosophy.
Let's start with what's actually happening when you tap your phone, and why it's weirder than you think.
You walk into a coffee shop, you order a $4.50 latte, you tap your phone. What just happened? Most people would say, money moved from my account to the coffee shop's account. That's wrong. Nothing moved anywhere. No packet of value traveled through the air.
What actually happened?
Your bank reduced a number in one column. The column labeled how much we owe Corn, and increased a number in a different column. Meanwhile, the coffee shop's bank, somewhere else entirely, increased a number in the column labeled how much we owe the coffee shop. That's it. Two ledger entries in two different banks that haven't even spoken to each other yet.
My bank just decided I have $4.50 less, and the merchant's bank decided they have $4.50 more, and we all agree this constitutes a payment.
They haven't settled yet. The actual settlement, the part where real money moves between the banks themselves, happens later through the central bank. Your bank and the merchant's bank are both keeping running tabs on what they owe each other, and at the end of the day, or in real time depending on the system, they net those obligations and settle the difference using central bank reserves.
There are actually two completely separate things happening. The thing I see, my balance going down, the merchant getting paid, and the thing happening behind the scenes between banks that I never see.
This is the three-layer model that makes sense of the whole thing. Layer 1, physical cash. That's a direct liability of the central bank. If you're holding a $20 bill, the Federal Reserve owes you, well, it owes you nothing really, except the promise that someone else will accept that 20. But legally, it's a central bank IOU. Layer 2, commercial bank deposits. That's what's in your checking account. That's not central bank money, it's a liability of your commercial bank to you. Your bank owes you those dollars. Layer 3, central bank reserves. These are accounts that commercial banks hold at the central bank, and they're used exclusively to settle obligations between banks. You and I can't access Layer 3.
When I look at my banking app and it says I have $2,000, what I'm actually looking at is my bank's IOU to me for $2,000, an IOU denominated in dollars.
The Bank of England has an explainer on this that's remarkably clear. They stated explicitly, money in the modern economy is a type of IOU. Your bank balance is an IOU from your bank to you. The cash in your wallet is an IOU from the central bank to you. And the reserves that banks hold at the central bank are an IOU from the central bank to the banks. The entire system is IOUs all the way down.
Which sounds alarming until you realize it's always been IOUs all the way down. Even when we had gold coins, the coin was an IOU. It was saying this much gold, trust me. You still had to trust the minter.
The scale of this is staggering. In the UK, only 6% of the money supply is physical cash. 94% exists purely as digital commercial bank money. The United States is similar. Most of what we call money has never been printed, never been minted, never physically existed at all.
Daniel's experience, never touching cash, living entirely in the digital layer, that's not some fringe lifestyle. That's how 94% of money already works.
To understand what digital money really is, we need to trace the path of a single payment from start to finish.
Let's do the coffee.
$4.50 latte. You tap your phone using Apple Pay or Google Pay. Your phone sends a token to the payment terminal, not your actual card number, a one-time cryptographic token. That token travels through the Visa or MasterCard network to your bank. Your bank checks if you have sufficient funds, and if you do, it sends back an authorization. That authorization travels back through the network to the terminal. The terminal beeps. You walk away with your coffee. Total elapsed time, maybe 2 seconds.
At that point, no money has moved.
What you have is a promise from your bank that it will pay the merchant's bank. The actual movement of money happens through the central bank settlement system. In the US, that's Fedwire, which is an RTGS, a real-time gross settlement system. In the UK, it's CHAPS. In Europe, it's Target 2. These systems settle trillions of dollars a day. Fedwire alone processes over $3 trillion daily. CHAPS handles about 600 billion pounds.
Real-time gross settlement means each transaction is settled individually and immediately, not batched up and netted at the end of the day.
So when the settlement actually happens, your bank's reserve account at the Federal Reserve is debited by $4.50, and the merchant's bank's reserve account is credited by the same amount. Only then, and this might happen seconds later or hours later depending on the system, has the payment truly settled. The central bank has adjusted its own ledger, and the central bank's ledger is the final word. There's no appealing a Fedwire entry.
The thing I think of as my money never leaves my bank. My bank just owes me less, and owes the merchant's bank more, and the central bank keeps track of who owes what to whom at the bank level.
Which means commercial bank money, your deposit, is fundamentally a promise to deliver central bank money on demand. When you withdraw cash from an ATM, you're converting a commercial bank IOU into a central bank IOU. When you transfer money to a friend at a different bank, you're instructing your bank to transfer some of its central bank reserves to your friend's bank. And your friend's bank then increases its IOU to your friend.
The phrase, I have money in the bank, is literally backwards. The bank has money, central bank reserves, and it owes you some of it.
And this is where the IOU framing from the Bank of England becomes so powerful. It's not a metaphor. It's a literal description of the legal relationship. Your deposit is an unsecured liability of the bank. If the bank fails, you're a creditor. You stand in line with other creditors.
Which brings us to the fundamental commitment Daniel asked about. What actually gives this whole structure legitimacy? If it's all just ledger entries and promises, what prevents the whole thing from collapsing into a shared delusion?
There's a school of thought called Chartalism, or the state theory of money, that answers this directly. It was first articulated by a German economist named Georg Friedrich Knapp in 1905, and has been developed more recently by economists like Randall Ray. The core argument is that money's value doesn't come from intrinsic worth or commodity backing. It comes from the state's power to impose tax liabilities. The government requires you to pay taxes. It requires those taxes to be paid in the specific currency, dollars, pounds, shekels, whatever. That requirement creates a universal need for that currency. Everyone in the economy needs to acquire dollars because everyone owes taxes in dollars. That underlying demand is what gives the currency its value. Not gold, not silver, not the full faith and credit of the government as a vague slogan, the concrete, enforceable obligation to pay taxes.
The fundamental commitment is the tax bill.
It's the strongest commitment a government can make. The government isn't just saying, we promise this money is good. It's saying, we will come after you with the full force of the law if you don't pay us in this specific currency. That creates a floor of demand that no commodity backing could match. Gold can lose value if people decide they don't want gold, but as long as the government can enforce tax collection, people will need the currency.
Which means the legitimacy of money is ultimately backed by the state's monopoly on legitimate violence. That's a bracing thought.
But it's also backed by two other legs of a stool. The first is legal tender laws. If someone owes you a debt, they can discharge it by paying in the legal tender currency, and you have to accept it. The second is network effects. The more people who accept a currency, the more useful it becomes, which makes more people accept it. Once a currency reaches critical mass, it's self-sustaining.
The three legs are: the state demands it for taxes, the law requires it to be accepted for debts, and everyone else already uses it, so you might as well too.
None of those legs requires anything physical. They're all social and legal commitments. The physical cash is just a convenient token representing those commitments.
Now that we know how the mechanism works, let's talk about what it means for the economy, for bank runs, and for the philosophy of value.
The most important implication is that if money is just an IOU, then earning money is creating a new IOU from someone to you, and spending money is transferring that IOU to someone else. Your paycheck is your employer's bank creating an IOU to you. Your rent payment is you transferring part of your bank's IOU to your landlord's bank. The entire economy is a web of promises, continuously created and extinguished, with the central bank as the final settlement layer.
Which makes the economy sound like a giant game of ledger ping pong.
It basically is, and that works fine until people stop trusting the IOUs. That's a bank run. And this is where the distinction between digital money and physical cash suddenly matters enormously.
Walk me through that.
In normal times, everyone treats commercial bank deposits as equivalent to cash. A dollar in your checking account spends just as easily as a dollar bill, but legally, they're completely different things. The dollar bill is a central bank liability. It's the final settlement asset. The dollar in your checking account is a promise from a private institution. If that institution fails, the promise might be broken.
In a bank run, depositors are essentially saying, "I don't trust your promise anymore. Give me the real thing."
The bank can't do it, because the bank only holds a fraction of its deposits as reserves. The rest is tied up in loans and investments. The bank is solvent on paper, its assets exceed its liabilities, but it's illiquid. It can't convert those assets to central bank money fast enough to meet the demand.
This is what happened with Silicon Valley Bank.
In March 2023, SVB experienced a bank run that was entirely digital. Depositors withdrew $42 billion in a single day, not by lining up at branches with withdrawal slips, by initiating wire transfers. The run happened at the speed of the internet. The bank's reserve balance at the Federal Reserve was drained in hours. The FDIC had to step in and guarantee the deposits.
That guarantee, deposit insurance, is the crucial backstop that prevents the IOU system from collapsing. The government steps in and says, "We'll make good on the bank's promises up to a certain amount."
$250,000 in the US, £85,000 in the UK. Above that, you're an unsecured creditor. Your digital balance is an unsecured IOU from a private company. Most people don't think about their bank account that way, but that's what it is.
Which is a bracing thing to realize about the number on your screen. Below the insurance limit, it's effectively a government-backed IOU. Above it, you're trusting that your bank is well managed.
This is what I mean when I say the mechanism is the philosophy. The abstract question, "What is money?" has a concrete answer. It's a hierarchy of IOUs, with the central bank at the top, commercial banks in the middle, and you and me at the bottom. The legitimacy comes from the state's tax power. The stability comes from deposit insurance and central bank lending. The digital experience is just the user interface for this entire legal and institutional apparatus.
If money is just a web of IOUs settled at the central bank, what should you actually do with this knowledge?
First, it changes how you think about bank risk. Your deposit is not a custodial account. The bank isn't holding your money in a vault with your name on it. It's an unsecured loan from you to the bank. Above the insurance limit, you have genuine counterparty risk. The digital nature of the balance doesn't change that. It just makes it easier to forget.
The app shows a number with a dollar sign, and the brain reads that as money in a box. But it's not in a box. It's lent out.
Second, the next time you tap to pay for something, mentally trace the path. That 450 latte involved your bank, a payment network, and the central bank settlement system. You're not moving money. You're sending instructions through the most sophisticated trust infrastructure ever built. The fact that it works, billions of times a day, across borders and currencies and institutions, with disputes and fraud detection and anti-money laundering checks all happening in milliseconds. It's genuinely remarkable.
We've built a global machine for managing promises, and we interact with it by tapping a piece of glass.
Third, and this gets to the heart of Daniel's question, money has a concrete answer. It's not mysterious. It's a tax credit issued by the state, distributed through the banking system as IOUs, and settled in central bank reserves. The value comes from the state's demand for it in tax payments, reinforced by legal tender laws and network effects. No mysticism required.
That's satisfying in a way. The thing that feels abstract and almost unreal. It's just numbers on a screen. Turns out to have a specific, traceable, legally enforceable foundation. It's not magic. It's infrastructure.
The infrastructure is remarkably resilient. It survived 2008, when the entire interbank lending market froze and central banks had to step in as lenders of last resort. It survived COVID, when the economy basically stopped and governments issued trillions in new debt. It survived the 2023 regional banking crisis. Each time, the system bent but didn't break.
The system survived because central banks and governments intervened massively each time. The infrastructure works, but it requires active maintenance.
That's fair. The system isn't self-sustaining in a pure sense. It requires a lender of last resort, deposit insurance, and a central bank willing to create reserves when the interbank market seizes up. But that's the design. The system was built with those backstops because the architects understood that a pure IOU system without a backstop is inherently fragile.
Which brings us to the philosophical twist in Daniel's question. He's essentially asking, if I never touch cash, am I experiencing money purely as a social construct?
And that's not a problem. It's just the reality. Money has always been a social construct. Gold coins were a social construct. They had value because everyone agreed they had value, and because the state accepted them for tax payments. The physical object was just the token. The social agreement was the money.
The difference is that with gold coins, the token itself had some intrinsic value. You could melt it down and make jewelry. With paper notes, the token has negligible intrinsic value, but you can hold it. With digital balances, there's no token at all. Just the agreement.
That's what makes people uncomfortable. There's nothing to hold. Nothing to put under the mattress. If the screens go dark, the money is gone, or at least inaccessible. But here's the thing. If the screens go dark, the economy has collapsed so thoroughly that paper money probably wouldn't save you either.
There's a certain type of person who keeps gold coins in a safe for exactly this scenario.
I'm not going to mock that impulse because it's rational at the extremes. But for the other 99.9% of scenarios, the digital IOU system is more robust than physical cash. Cash can be stolen, destroyed in a fire, lost. A digital ledger entry at a regulated bank with deposit insurance is harder to permanently lose.
One last question to leave you with. What happens when the central bank itself becomes your bank?
This is the CBDC question. Central bank digital currencies. The Federal Reserve has been researching a digital dollar. China has already rolled out the digital yuan to hundreds of millions of users. The European Central Bank is working on the digital euro. The idea is that instead of holding deposits at commercial banks, layer 2 money, you could hold an account directly at the central bank, layer 3 money, available to everyone.
Which would collapse the three-layer model into 2 layers, or maybe 1.
It raises enormous questions. If everyone can hold central bank money directly, why would anyone keep money in a commercial bank? Would commercial banks still be able to create money through lending? Would the central bank become the sole issuer of money, effectively nationalizing the payment system? These aren't theoretical questions. They're being debated in central banks around the world right now.
For Daniel, who's already living a cashless life, a CBDC would make almost no difference to his daily experience. He'd still tap his phone. The balance would still be a number on a screen. But the legal nature of that number would be fundamentally different. It would be a direct claim on the central bank, not a claim on a commercial bank that itself has a claim on the central bank.
Which would make the system simpler but also more concentrated. Right now, the commercial banking layer provides a buffer, a distributed network of institutions making credit decisions. If everything consolidates at the central bank, all those decisions get centralized too.
That's a whole episode on its own. But the point for today is that Daniel's worry about money being just digital is really a worry about trust. and trust in money has always been the foundation. Gold coins were trusted because of their weight and purity. Paper notes were trusted because of the issuer's promise. Digital balances are trusted because of the settlement infrastructure and the legal framework behind it. The medium changes. Good trust doesn't.
The fundamental commitment Daniel asked about, the thing that gives the system legitimacy, is the state's power to tax, reinforced by legal tender laws and the sheer network effects of a currency everyone already uses. It's not a physical thing. It's a set of institutions, laws, and social agreements. But those are real. They're enforced by courts, backed by the state's monopoly on force, and tested daily in trillions of dollars of transactions. That's not nothing.
It's actually more solid than gold, if you think about it. Gold's value fluctuates based on what people are willing to pay for it. The dollar's value fluctuates too, but the obligation to pay taxes in dollars doesn't fluctuate. The IRS doesn't accept gold. It accepts dollars. That's an anchor that no commodity can match.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In Labrador, in the early 1900s, missionaries documenting the Inuktitut dialect of Inuktitut discovered that its speakers treated the thing being acted upon in a transitive sentence with the same grammatical case as the subject of an intransitive verb, a pattern known as ergativity, which means that when an Inuktitut speaker said the hunter killed the seal, the word for seal was grammatically marked the same way as hunter, in the hunter slept. To an English speaker, this is roughly as disorienting as a unit conversion, where meters and kilograms suddenly swap roles depending on whether anything is moving.
The seal gets the same grammatical treatment as a sleeping hunter. That's going to sit with me.
I'm now going to spend the rest of the day trying to map that onto English sentences and failing.
The next time you tap your phone to buy coffee, you're not moving money. You're participating in a three-layer system of promises. Your bank's IOU to you, transferred to the merchant's bank, settled in central bank reserves, all backed ultimately by the government's power to tax. It's the most sophisticated trust infrastructure ever built, and it works so smoothly that we forget it exists. That's worth remembering.
If central banks do roll out digital currencies to everyone, the distinction Daniel is wrestling with between real cash money and just digital bank money may disappear entirely. Whether that's a good thing is a question we'll probably be discussing on this show for years.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We'll be back soon with another one.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.